South Dakotans are reluctant to change the state constitution, and they said so on Election Day. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, November 6th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, South Dakotans voted on 7 ballot questions, a congressional race, and numerous state house seats, and they showed up strong for Donald Trump. We will check in with SDPB's reporters with the latest from election night. Then our Dakota political junkies break down the results and we'll talk about where we go from here. Mike Card and John Hunter are with us. Voters made their voices heard. How will a new state legislature enact the will of the people? We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. 11 abortion ballot questions went before Americans yesterday. That was a record for a single election year. The South Dakota measure, known as Amendment G, failed. Here to help explain what happened, we have SDPB's political and policy reporter, Lee Strubinger. Lee, welcome.
Good to be here.
What happened?
Not entirely sure. Rick Weiland is not answering his phone right now, but I am told that Dakotans for Health, which was the group that brought this ballot question, is working on a press release right now. However, on the other side, I spoke to the two chairs of the Life Defense Fund, one of the two groups that were opposed to this particular effort. They were kind of the first to kind of get out there and really look at this kind of from a legal perspective, mm-hmm. and then also just opposing it in general. And their message was that this was too extreme. And, you know, as it stands right now, 60% of the state's voters agree with that.
All right. 2006, 2008, voters rejected near total abortion bans. Now we are seeing this swing the other way. What changed?
You know, that's something I asked Leslie Unruh, who's been a longtime anti-abortion advocate here in Sioux Falls. And she was involved in those other two campaigns. And here's what she had to say.
What was the difference between tonight and 06 and 08?
Huge difference. Back then, I think the infrastructure was totally different. And the other side just raised a bunch of money and went up with a bunch of ads. And I think the fact that we had a ground game that was like nothing I've ever experienced. And then we had some people that had been affected by this issue, as like you and I had talked about before, and they stepped up. You know, there's just more people understand this issue in a different way. A lot of people have had abortions, and they don't want that for somebody else. They want to do more. We talked about love. Let's love people, you know?
So, Leslie, when I asked her about that particular ground game, she said they had captains and co-captains basically in every county who were working on this issue. And when one couldn't do it, other people stepped up. And that was just really kind of what their efforts kind of looked like on that regard.
And a lot of women. We've learned through your reporting on Unplanned Democracy, through our conversations with the New York Times reporter who have recently written a pretty definitive history of what led to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. A lot of women have taken to the streets to be anti-abortion access. And we've also, of course, seen millions of women be pro-abortion access. Is this over? Is this a done deal right now? What happens in the legislative? Last year, I thought during the legislative session, lawmakers would be discussing abortion. I was wrong. They did not. They left it to this ballot question. Now this ballot question has failed. Is that a mandate for lawmakers to really do nothing? Or will we see something in the future?
You know, that was something that I asked Representative John Hansen, who is a co-chair with Leslie Unruh, kind of about this. And he said that, you know, there are conversations that are happening. I think there are always conversations about our state's abortion law. One of the things that stuck out to me about the one presidential debate that we had was that President Donald Trump said that he supports exceptions for rape and incest. We don't have that in our current law. And so I asked him, given the position of where, the president-elect is at now, will we see changes to that? And he said, you know, basically it's kind of too early to tell at this point, but the conversations are happening. Yeah.
So before, as I understand it, part of the reason those exceptions were not put in was because South Dakotans wanted this to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now it is in a completely different political landscape, and it is conceivable that exceptions for rape and incest might show up again. It's also conceivable it might not, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
All right. Let's. We're at 90%. We're broadcasting live today. So right now, Secretary of State's office has 90% reporting precinct. So we still don't know everything that's happening in the state legislative races. Once again, it's a good reminder to say these are all unofficial results until the canvassing occurs. But we're still really waiting on Minnehaha County. What do we know now, Lee, about legislative races in the state?
Well, that the Republican Party will still maintain their supermajority in the state legislature.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah. I kind of was. But
you were. Yeah, oh, tell me about it.
But I think what's going to be more interesting to see is kind of how the ideological breakdown of the Republican Party really sort of shakes out. And because I haven't had too much time to really kind of dive into that yet, but I do plan on it. But what I have been able to look at is sort of how Democrats have fared so far in this election. And again, without counting Minnehaha County, where there's a lot of the Democrats get elected for the state house, I was taking a look at who has and hasn't lost. And Democrat Sean Bordeaux, who was a senator in the Rosebud and Chamberlain district, he lost his seat there. It went to a Republican. I'm trying to think of who else. It's still kind of up in the air. I don't know if they'll gain maybe as many seats as they hope to. There was one particular race where Democrats did pick up a seat, which was District 32 in Rapid City. It kind of encompasses North Rapid City and downtown Rapid City as well. And I spoke with Nicole Urie-Balk earlier this morning just about her approach to this particular race.
We had a great team, and really I knew door knocking was a really important aspect, and just getting out and having those conversations with people, trying to show up to as many events as possible and listen to people as much as possible. And then we did really try to work the social media presence and Google Ads and just all the things just to get my name out there. And that turned out, I guess, to work.
So one of the things that I think we're both hearing from Leslie Unruh and Nicole Urie-Balk is that, you know, in this age of social media, it is important to be on social media, but there still is that ground game that needs to really happen there.
All right. So is District 32 one that was redistricted?
Yeah. So yeah. District 32 changed a lot during the last legislative redistricting. Mm-hmm. Part of that change was when you looked at North Rapid City, it was split into four different districts. That neighborhood up in Rapid City has a lot more Democratic voters there. It's all now in a single district, along with much of downtown and kind of south to Monument Hospital there.
All right. So as we are watching again, and it's hard to tell what's going to happen with some of those Minnehaha County races, we know how they're looking. It doesn't look like the Democrats are going to have a very big presence in the House of Representatives or the state Senate. And when we saw the primary, a lot of sort of middle in the road or centrist Republicans lost their seats, people like Jean Hanhoff, to further right candidates. Are those Democrats going to have the potential influence that they will that they might have had last session? Because last session, it kind of mattered if they were with the Freedom Caucus on something, if they were not. Does that influence diminish now, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's still too soon to sell. It's early. It's still too soon.
Lee Strubinger was up until 3 o'clock in the morning, at least, turning in stories. So we appreciate your staying awake for us here.
But I still think that will still be a factor, right? And I think it really, again, comes down to that kind of ideological divide within the Republican caucus in the state house.
Yeah. Lee Strubinger, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
You bet.
We will take a quick break. When we come back, John Hunter and Michael Card are here. Our Dakota political junkies will provide analysis on everything from Governor Noem's presence in Florida to those ballot questions. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we have our Dakota political junkies with us in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio today. We are broadcasting live as part of SDPB's special election coverage for Decision 2024. John Hunter is here. He is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader and a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame, and also Dr. Michael Card, professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota. John, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori.
Mike Card, welcome. Thanks.
I'm pleased to be here and to be asked to be here.
All right. John Hunter, I understand that you have a really strong record of editorial writing in the Madison Daily Leader, except maybe this one time where you made a prediction that did not age well. Did not age as well as you have, sir.
As the writer of almost 6,000 editorials, I was the farthest off this one than I ever have been, so I set new records. I thought the idea of removing the or updating gender references would be a landslide victory that would be some huge number that everyone would agree in that, and it not only didn't have the landslide, it lost, and so 58-42.
The land slid the other way.
Yeah, the land slid out from underneath my feet.
I feel like this is worth talking about partially because we really didn't talk about it much. This was a bill that came up during the State House, and I think it was Erin Tobin and some other female lawmakers who said, we have a female governor. The state constitution should represent that in our language, so we would like to...
The governor mentioned it in State of the State address.
Yep, the governor mentioned it. I'm not sure if there was applause.
She might have done it in the inaugural address, even. I mean, it was early. Yeah. It was well before Tobin and those put it together.
So there was this idea that it was a measure to honor and celebrate South Dakota's first female governor by changing the language to say, the governor will do this and the governor will do that. South Dakotans didn't rebuke Governor Noem necessarily in this, but they definitely didn't want the language changed. Mike Card, since we can't trust John Hunter on this topic, what happened here?
A flash of honesty.
This is one that I got right, and it was largely based on anecdotal evidence that I heard people talking to me saying, this is the legislature putting a woke amendment in front of us. And I just shook my head and asked people to clarify and said, well, it's trying to make all genders look alike. It's like the pronouns. And I'm just shaking my head, you know, as opposed to replacing he with the title of the person who has the legal authority in statute in the Constitution to make decisions or to perform functions.
And on the ballot, in the ballot question, it said it would cost money, too. There was a fiscal note
that's great.
On your ballot. Why would it cost money to change the...
I didn't even see the fiscal note.
Well,
it must have been very small.
It specifically dealt with the reprinting of the state constitution when it didn't need to be reprinted, despite the fact that there were three other amendments that may have passed.
That would have caused the reprinting of the... All right. So, John?
Well, there's a couple things that... For one, I think there was perhaps a little of vote no on everything. And I think some people, especially constitutional amendments, and there, we'll see an exception here in a moment with the Medicaid work requirement. But I think there's a certain portion of South Dakota's voters who say, don't mess with the Constitution. Bring all the initiated measures you want. You know, refer statutes, whatever those things are, but let's not vote on the Constitution every time. So I think there was some of that. Kind of leave well enough alone.
Yeah. And then also there is a nuance, though, in the vote no. Because I did hear voters tell me that someone had knocked on their door and they said, by the way, you should just vote for me. I'm your candidate. And those ballot questions, just vote no on all of them for simplicity's sake. So possibly some fatigue, possibly some just great communication and advertising from different groups that were just like, no on this, no on that. It's too extreme to sort of build a collective no. Yeah. But then, Mike, there's a nuance here. They vote no on the referred law, which is a rebuke to lawmakers, and then they vote yes on Amendment F, which is a, we want the lawmakers to be able to add work requirements to, and again, unofficial results. We don't have all the tallies in. Some things may change, but it looks like F is going to get the support to go forward. So there it's like, yes, we want lawmakers to have the option to do this. So it's, they didn't just, people didn't just go in and fill in, no one walk out the door.
No, they didn't. I think to a large extent, people, I saw a lot of cheat sheets in people's hands as they were going in to vote.
Yeah.
Seven is a lot. It's not the most. In the past five elections, we've had more. We've had 10 and 11 in 2012 and 2016. I think the larger part here was the significant efforts to get people to vote no. The linguists tell me that the word extreme does things to people's minds that just absolutely turns them off. Too extreme is exactly the phrase you would use if you want to defeat something. Constitutional amendments over the state's history are barely above 50%, and we consider we only had initiated amendments since 1974. Initiated measures don't do all that well. They're underwater in terms of less than 50% pass. The ones that work are, if you consider voting no on a referred measure, that's about 60% success rate. If you consider voting no a success, because it's the petitioner said, you know, if we think an initiated measure is there ought to be a law, a referred law is there ought not to be a law.
Back to the drawing board.
Go
try again.
Yep.
The other thing that we really learned about this, the ballot question was just how much it's, we saw it change through polling, through Mason-Dixon and, Newswatch and the Cheeseman Center for Democracy at USD. So we saw the evolution of the polls and then that huge push of money at the end where if you, boy, I watched the football game. On Sunday night, I watched the Vikings game on broadcast television, and every ad was... I have a friend from Wisconsin who was like, don't even tell me about it. Like, you cannot imagine what it's like to live in a swing state. I'm like, but this is awful. Anyway, so all the money was rolling in, and it was a lot of no on abortion. It was a lot of, we might need to change the law, but this is too extreme. And marijuana was... That was the other one I was surprised that it was Donald Trump wants you to vote for... marijuana, which I thought was a bit of a stretch. I couldn't quite tell where they were getting their footage from on that ad. But marijuana failed, too. So marijuana, recreational marijuana, abortion, did they come back, John? Are these the death knell? Because we also saw a huge, the Democrats did not do well. It's not like we saw a bunch of more progressive issues make it and then Democrats failed. Everything failed. This was a Republicans showed up very strongly yesterday to say what it means to be Republican. Are those issues dead?
Well, I think there will be, if I can predict that, and my track record is not good. But
we can forgive you with the, the constitutional linguistic obscure.
But I think I really do believe in the fatigue thing, and I think we might see fewer initiatives coming up or... maybe referrals will stay popular, but constitutional amendments and so on. So I just think the success rate of those is not good. Now, things like abortion, I think will go on for forever. Taxes possibly could. I think it's worth talking a little bit about the sales tax and that.
For sure.
You know, that could take a different form, but with that kind of 70-30 wipeout. And now, granted, it was not clearly defined. There were some things about, you know, anything consumed, which would be medicine or alcohol or
gasoline,
whatever.
Gasoline was my favorite that they were talking about for human consumption.
Yes.
Well,
because you use it up.
Right.
Yes,
right.
Because it's something that people buy that's used up, and then they go buy it again. That's why it was a consumable, potentially. I think that was a bit of a stretch.
Right.
And I think it was unlikely that they were going to stop.
Right. But that's, you know, there was a long time when I think that vote would have been closer.
Yeah.
But I think, and I think fairly, people were worried that there would be another tax or there would be sharp budget cuts.
Right.
And, you know, if teachers are already, you know, we need to make progress on teacher pay, that this would slow that even further. So long answer to a short question, Lori, is that I think some of these may come back, but I think fewer of them in the next election.
Yeah.
You know, I think for me on these measures, certainly GH28 and the referred law 21, what struck me was how well organized the campaigns were, and mostly on the no side, and they were well funded. You know, if we look at G, clearly the major proponent of Amendment G left out the National Abortion Rights League and Planned Parenthood. They sat on the sidelines. The money came in very, very late from Illinois. Again, we tend not to like out-of-state money in ballot issues. We love it on candidate campaigns. We're not hypocritical at all here in South Dakota. But that really made things difficult is if you don't craft your proposed legislation, in this case, proposed constitutional amendment, with all of the stakeholders who are likely to support you that already have a, you know, in politics we call it a ground game, which is an organization, you're not going to get very far. And they didn't get very far. And the same thing with the drafting of the IM-28 on the grocery tax, which right. was human consumption. He didn't follow the LRC's recommendation. Their initial cost estimate was based on groceries because they said, well, if what you really want is taxes on groceries, which is well-defined in our statute, largely because of the streamlined sales tax project. So if you ignore that and you talk about human consumption, one opposition was, well, this is an income tax. Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken was the chair of that committee.
Right.
Then we're worried about what all are we taxing? And now the cost estimate for human consumption, even though we can't define it, goes up to $630 million. Well, then we see, as you said, state employees are worried. Teachers are worried. Students were worried about tuition going up. All on something that could have been fixed by the legislature that they had 8 months.
Yeah.
But it took it out of the realm of, do we not want a tax on groceries versus you just need to vote no on this. This is so terrible.
Hmm. Let's take that as a bridge to the national election, because the economy and the fear over what you would not be able to afford. I heard a lot of people in business in the previous week saying, like, everything in business is just kind of on hold. People are just waiting, you know, to figure out what happens with the election. And I kept saying, well, what do they think will happen when Donald Trump is elected? What is the policy? And the answers were pretty vague. It was just a feeling that if he went back to the White House, even if they didn't like him at all, even if they had disassociated themselves from him as a person, they had a feeling, a strong feeling, that the economy was going to be better. So people are worried about their pocketbooks. Is it? It's always the economy in some ways, right? Is the economy stupid?
James Carville's curse on us.
what stands out to you in this with the idea of an un certainly some people admire Donald Trump, but I heard a lot of people say they had concerns about his character. I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say a lot of people who voted for him were not sure they like him. However, they want him in the White House. What's going on?
As it was relayed on Morning Edition this morning, they want a strong man. They want someone who will change things, even if it means breaking them to get that change. People's perspective of the economy is largely based on their pocketbook. Wages have not gone up as fast as inflation has gone down. So many people are buying things that cost 19-20% more than they did in 2019. That's rational thinking. I don't like this. I don't have the money to pay for these groceries. You know, and some were saying, you know, it costs $4 for a dozen eggs. Well, where are you buying those eggs at? but the other, you know, and that's...
I totally get the egg argument if you are a bakery.
If
you have to buy a whole lot of eggs, I'm all ears. Yeah. But for, like, you know, a regular family of four, you got a big egg budget.
Yeah. Well,
but eggs to that point becomes you can remember the price of eggs. You can measure
right.
other things by it.
Gasoline is another one because
down
it's
the
advertised in front of you everywhere. Mm-hmm. All of these staple items, they have gone up in price. And some of that is due to price gouging. Some of that is due to shortages. We've got bird flu all over the place. But most of us don't pay attention to the news. And to realize that there is bird flu, there is shortages, that we've killed off millions of chickens for fear of transferring that to the human beings, and all I see is what affects my pocketbook. Mm-hmm. That's rational thinking. It is. But
is it based on evidence?
Well, it isn't based on all the evidence. It's based on what easily comes in is things we already believe. Boy, I think prices are going up. I'm going to see everything with that. It's sort of like watching a sports game. I can easily see the fouls that the other team makes, but I have a hard time seeing the fouls that my team makes. And that's because stuff comes in easily that fits with what we already believe, and we may not even see evidence that would contradict what we believe.
Yeah.
Well, people may not listen to the news, but they listen to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
They're listening to you right now, help them sort through all of this. So, John, the president, former President Donald Trump, and now president-elect, is getting stronger in his support. The felonies, the convictions, the controversies, his behavior on the campaign trail is not deterring people from liking him. In fact, more people are solidifying around him in America. What does this say about America and the direction that we're going?
I can't say definitively, but I have some thoughts. And part of it is, I heard as much now as ever, and you hear it a little bit every election where people say, gee, I wish we had different candidates to choose from. Right. I don't like either one. So there was a little bit of, I think, maybe a lot of this election, I'm voting for the one that I like that can do the most damage or whatever.
Right.
You know,
lesser of two evils.
One's right. Lesser of two evils. Thank you. But the idea of a candidate attracting votes rather than repelling votes is still a bit of a mystery. That's just not what our long history has been. We used to kind of be inspired by candidates, and you'd want someone to lead you. And I think there was just an awful lot of, so people would find things, you know, a lot of people would say, well, I don't like Trump, but I really don't like Biden at first. And then when Harris came in, I said, well, I don't like her either. The interesting thing for president, people vote on a really broad range of reasons, and not all of them are economy or something. I mean, they're tall or short or old or young or whatever. I hear people voting all the time. They didn't like Kamala's laugh, right? That was, why would you vote for someone or against someone because of the way they laugh?
It's just a very standard anti-female candidate thing. I mean, let's just call that what that is. If you are picking out a woman's laugh or her ambition, or her hair, you can pretty much just say that's something that female candidates, we've seen it with Kristi Noem, we've seen it with Kamala Harris. It's bipartisan or nonpartisan criticism of female candidates.
And I don't know if, I can't explain it very well. I didn't think Donald Trump would get more votes this time than he did last time. I didn't think he would have converted people. Yeah. Now, the one thing about the economy, we did run up huge deficits again in the last 4 years. I don't know if people pay attention to that. Much of that was kind of COVID started, or at least COVID catalyst. But then I think there was this whole infrastructure thing and so forth. And I don't know if there's some thought that that's spun out of control.
Inflation Reduction
Act, And we have to go back further, because the 2017 Targeted Jobs Tax Act was $2 trillion all by itself. There was another trillion in COVID aid under Donald Trump. So there's $3 trillion there. And then we have $4 trillion under Biden. And the Wall Street Journal and The Economist and the Tax Foundation, all incredibly sarcasm liberal organizations, they are not liberal organizations, have predicted that Donald Trump will add another $7.5 trillion in deficits if his policies, the things he promised during the last days of the campaign, which is one way to get people to vote for you, is let's eliminate taxes on tips, let's eliminate taxes on Social Security, let's have lots of giveaway programs.
Taxes right.
Seven
overtime,
and a half.
Yeah.
Talk to
more
say,
taxes
yeah,
on
tell
overtime.
Rich people, I know you're already rich, but we're going to cut your taxes more.
Right.
You
I
can
think he
promise
said he was
going
to cut taxes on people's overtime, so they should get to take that home. Harris said, you know, all kinds of things that I'm going to make it so Americans only have to work one job. I was like, how do you do that? So there were a whole lot of promises. Yep. What I'm trying to figure out, Mike, is this idea of are people nostalgic for pre-pandemic Trump economy, like what they remember about that? Or are we saying, like, he didn't get enough time to dismantle and reconstruct the nation that we want, so we need to send him back? Are we trying to go back or are we trying to go forward?
Well, that's an interesting thought because, in essence, that former president, now President-elect Trump, has suggested that it really was the case that he wasn't able to do what he wanted to do. And
darn pandemic got in the way.
Well, it was the pandemic, and I think he's going to, he would say, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think there's lots of evidence. He would say that what happened is people held me back, people I appointed to bosses that I, to jobs
John
that
Kelly,
I thought.
John Kelly, HR McMaster, Jim McManus,
even,
who all came out and said he shouldn't be president, and they're not going to go back with him.
No.
So we're going to find out what happens next.
Well, we may end up with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., heading some degree of infectious disease.
All right. So John Thune, we know, is at Senate, is turning for the Senate or turning for Republicans. So you're going to have, what do we know historically speaking about when the president is in a party and so is Congress? Will we see more progress in a certain direction or less because it's a sort of a pipe dream that everybody's going to get along and pass some?
Well, I think we know in the Senate part, that's where confirmation of appointed officials go through treaties and things of that nature. The Senate is going to be in the control of the Republican Party, and it will be a John, whether it's John Thune or John Cornyn, is likely to be the majority leader. We don't know which one yet. The issue there is he will get his appointments made. The judicial appointments, the appointments to the federal judiciary, whether it be a Supreme Court opening, whether it be cabinet secretaries, undersecretaries, the 3,000 appointed positions not subject to civil service protections. Mm-hmm. There's the effort to remove civil service protections to make more employment at will. But generally, the Senate goes along unless it's an extreme case, if they're in the same party. I cut you off.
John Hunter. I just also want to ask, bring Kristi Noem in here, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, who was in Florida, not in Sioux Falls. John Thune was in Sioux Falls speaking to Republicans there. They were applauding him in ways that they hadn't just a couple years ago, right? Remember? And so there's an interesting flip. What happens to her next? What do you want to add to Mike's thoughts here?
Well, just one quick deal on Congress. If you have a split Congress where the Republicans control the Senate and the Democrats control the House, there tends to be less legislation that makes it all the way to the president's desk. But Trump in particular has taken executive actions farther than others, and I think this does shift more power to the administration from the Congress, which was odd that Congress is almost abdicating some of its responsibilities, and they don't get anything done, so the administration takes action anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So in my view, that's a misbalance of power. I think that Congress is leaving some of its responsibilities. Now, talking about Governor Noem, I think there probably is a spot for her somewhere in the federal government. Don't know where that is. I don't think it's probably a cabinet-level position, but she has been loyal to him through all the, the felony convictions and so forth. So Trump tends to reward his loyalists and punish his detractors. And so I think there probably is, if she chooses, and I think she probably would like that, would like a position in Washington. So I think it might be available.
We need a farm bill. We need a balanced budget. There's some pretty big things. There was a bipartisan immigration reform package that was tanked. So there are questions about immigration
by President
reform.
Trump.
By President Trump on the campaign trail, by the former president on the campaign trail. Harris tried to use that to get votes ineffectively. People didn't buy that for whatever reason, nationwide at least.
Yep.
Does this Congress come back ready to work and ready to? I guess I'm expressing skepticism that even if you have your entire party together, that you're going to be able to just move big omnibus packages forward in a way. How clear is the road ahead, really? This is still the American government. It's still a democracy that it's designed to chug along at a slower pace.
Right. We don't know how the House is going to turn out yet. There's still a number of races yet to be decided. All revenue packages proposals have to originate in the House of Representatives, meaning they have to get out. The Speaker controls the agenda in the House. They may not come out as desired unless they are part of an omnibus package where, okay, I'll take this, but I have to give you that to get there. And that increases spending generally.
That is the, I think, the next best question coming up in the next 4 years is, will the checks and balances work in Congress and in the courts? Will those three branches of government work as they are designed, or will they be overcome in this wave? It's a concern of many Americans, I think. And there, I'd heard people who'd vote for either candidate and said, "I just hope there's a split, that it's not all Republican or all Democrat. That they hope there is
that
In fact, I heard it more than once. It was not just an anecdotal
thing. So we still have a sense that we are, even though we're a nation divided and a nation polarized, that we are pluralistic in the sense that we are going to work together. And we do. I mean, there are millions of people who voted for Kamala Harris. So there's still, I think Alexander Hefner said, the electorate smoothie. And so I mean, even though this is a really red state, he's like, he always pushes back against the idea that it's a red state because there are so many people who voted, you know, for Sheryl Johnson. They're still here. They're in that smoothie. And we all have to work together to meet the needs of people in rural South Dakota and people in the most urban downtown area that we have produced.
Well, you're right, and I've said this on this show before, is that we take 52, 48 victories for someone as if it were a landslide.
Right, yeah.
And it's not, I mean, again, there are people who, these are a lot of narrow victories. I think, in fact, the whole Electoral College thing is weird. I was trying to explain it to someone yesterday where he said, well, if you win Georgia 51 to 49, you get all their votes. You don't get some allocated percentage. So it's, I mean, the all or nothing nature of our democracy, where if you win 51%, then you have control of something, does ignore the 49% who voted for the other. So in the best situation, you'd have a chance to listen to both and incorporate ideas and come together.
Right.
You know, we certainly have two competing philosophies in our country, one of which is still based, for me, I think of it as a New Deal philosophy. We are here to help everyone. And that helping everyone means providing opportunities. The other philosophy is the purpose of government is to make the market operate efficiently and effectively, and it may hurt individuals. That, I think, is what's called neoliberalism to us pointy-headed academic types. It's liberal philosophy, meaning freedom for the individual, and the individual is what takes place in the marketplace. Yeah. So while we don't know how those are going to shake out. Part of what we're seeing in the battle for the legislature that we heard Lee talk about earlier, whether it's the Freedom Caucus, which is always interesting because the list was always put up in the Senate lobby and then torn down moments later. So we don't really know who's in it. But we know that there's going to be challenges in the legislature in terms of organizing based on the Freedom Caucus and what I would label as stalwart Republicans, traditional Eisenhower, Reagan. But those two philosophies are operating, but the Freedom Caucus seems to be blending the two. And we see that with the Josh Hawleys at the national level. We see it with the Ted Cruzes. We see this sort of movement. Well, we do have a role for government, and it's involved, which is not traditional in the past 40 years Republican thinking. Instead, we're seeing a blending, and much like a glass-covered coffin, remains to be seen what'll happen.
All right, we're going to leave it there for now.
The pointy head thing is sticking with me somehow.
There's so much sticking with me. I wish we had another hour. John Hunter, Mike Carr, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Laurie.
We have SDPB CJ Keene with us after the break, and South Dakota Secretary of State Monet Johnson has an update on that ballot count. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, earlier in the hour, we heard from SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, Lee Strubinger. Now we are checking in with SDPB's CJ Keene, who is seated in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio today. CJ, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
All right, what have you got for us this morning?
Well, let's start with state auditors because, or county auditors in South Dakota, because I called plenty of them last night. I called them East River, West River, Reservation Country, everything. And one of the big takeaways that I got from that is turnout. There were big lines right here in Pennington County. In Coddington County, the turnout was really good. But one of the interesting notes that I took from there is they tallied 7,200 plus absentee votes. About 38% of their votes came in absentee in one way or another. So it was definitely a pretty decent turnout, at least from those on the ground here in South Dakota. Even up in Harding County, one of their precincts ran out of I voted stickers. So it's a pretty good showing in every corner of the state.
We didn't run out of ballots, just stickers. I think we can manage the scarcity of the sticker. Tell me a little bit about who else you've been talking to today.
So I also followed initiated measure 28. Of course, that is your human consumption tax. And that was a bit of a battle coming up to the election day. And here we have the voice of Nathan Sanderson. He's the executive director of the State Retailers Association. It was a pretty good night for him.
This is a great outcome. Obviously, we believed from the beginning that IM-28 was poorly drafted and would have negative consequences for South Dakota. And I think that the results of the election are showing that South Dakota citizens agreed with that. I definitely think that that was a product of people really digging into what the measure actually does. The measure did not use the language that would have done what the sponsors had proposed to do.
Along with that, he really attributes the strength of this showing to the dozens of groups and municipalities that formed this coalition with the retailers.
We had just a tremendous coalition from all across the state. 68 different organizations were opposed. Around 80 cities and towns passed resolutions of opposition. So we had a lot of really good grassroots support. The polling that we saw early, you know, indicated that 2/3 of South Dakotans would vote for such a measure. But I had said multiple times that I thought the poll asked the wrong question.
And the right question in that situation would be a grocery tax specific question, not the question that was put in front of voters this election season.
So we did see that that support wane in the weeks up to election day to get where we're at now with the actual ballot count. Do you think the municipalities really had influence in this?
Well, it's really important to note that around 80 cities or towns passed resolutions. That includes right here in Rapid City. The mayor of Sioux Falls was involved in this initiative, No on 28. So it's hard to say for sure exactly how much influence they may have had, but I mean, it definitely isn't easy to write off that they could have had a significant influence on their, at least their local voters.
Right. Any final thoughts, CJ Keene, that do you notice during election night?
Well, more important than anything, there were very minor issues that were reported in, say, Fall River County. We can be pretty certain that South Dakota's election was at least reasonably safe.
Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Happy to do it, Lori.
And now we welcome South Dakota's Secretary of State, Monet Johnson, to the program. Secretary of State, welcome to The Moment. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on your program.
We've been carefully talking about how little sleep some of our reporters have had, but I'm guessing you're not particularly well rested either. Tell us a little bit about your day yesterday.
It was very good. You know, my office is a resource to the auditors, so we're here answering all their questions. Some of our new auditors hadn't gone through that before. And I just wanted to do a shout out. They did an awesome job. The election workers were fabulous. They put in a long day and a long night, but it was a great election. Those of us probably survived on snacks, a little bit of sleep, and I was wearing my slippers towards the evening. So
now you campaigned on making sure that auditors had the training that they needed. So tell me a little bit about how that has gone and what kinds of questions they were asking for clarification from your office.
Yes, we actually in the off years do the 2-day county auditor workshop, and it's pretty much elections from A to Z. And we go through anything you can probably think of, a lot of scenarios. The auditors, we actually did coordinated by some of our seasoned auditors. They did the post-election audit training because, as you know, it was new this year. The primary was the first time we had done one. And so we're looking forward to the post-election audit for the general election. And that just proves that the tabulators are doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. They're counting the votes just as the voter checked the box. What we do is if they have questions on if there's issues with the tabulators, if there's issues with the papers, if there's just anything that they need to do. And a lot of the day was spent doing driver's license lookup for someone who had come to the voting booth and just to make sure that they were in or not. Did they need a provisional ballot? Different things like that. So it was just being a resource to the 66 county auditors and the election workers, and I thought it went really well. We did a lot of talking yesterday. You probably did too, didn't you? Yeah,
a little bit. So help listeners understand, the results we're seeing today are unofficial results. Things need to be certified. What's the difference between the canvassing process and the post-election audit? Help people understand how that works and what will happen between now and mid-November.
Yes, the auditors still have a lot to do. We are waiting on one county to finish up. We heard that that should be hopefully by 2 p.m. So what is on our website is the unofficial results, and that will stay like that until the actual county canvass that they do, the auditor does with the county commissioners, where they go through the results, then it's signed off. That's a certified copy that gets sent to our office no later than Monday, November 11th, and of course that's a holiday. So we need to have all of that ready for the statewide canvass, which will be in the Capitol at 1 p.m. on the 12th, and that is where the governor's office, the attorney general's office, my office, we go through each one of those counties' counts, and then we make sure everything all adds up, and then once that is all done, we sign that off, and that's the official results. So that would be on November 12th. So then that would be the official count.
We have been hearing again and again about this being the most really scrutinized American election ever. And I want to go back to what you said about those auditor workshops. Can people come in, citizens? How are you helping regular South Dakotans understand and trust in the process?
Well, one thing that we have had in process for many years is we have a paper ballot. So, and you have to be a U.S. citizen to register to vote. So they have to prove that. The auditors are in charge of that part of the process, and we assist them in their questions. And when we go to the voting booth, it's a paper ballot, and we require ID. And for those that want to watch the election process, we've encouraged poll watchers to take part in that. Yeah. And the tabulators are not hooked to the internet. So we just stress that, you know, election integrity, we have secure, safe elections. And when I go to the National Association of Secretaries of State conferences, they all want to be like South Dakota. So we've run great elections for many years.
Thank you for that. I want to jump in with one more question before we run up on the clock here. 2 p.m., sure. Minnehaha County, any reason why?
Well, they just had a lot of absentee ballots to process. For those, you know, they can't process those till after 7 p.m. because they do the regular ballots, and then that's when other counties, even Pennington, had a lot they had to do. They have to manually, like, take them out of the envelope and then to process them. And there were many that they had to do. So I just wanted to do a shout out to Pennington and Minnehaha. They have just dealt with an awful lot of absentee ballot. My count, I think, is about 150,000 so far, you know, in South Dakota. But we'll know those exact numbers when the auditors give us their reports. But that's an awful lot of ballots to process.
We really appreciate you showing up for the listeners of South Dakota today. Thank you so much for
being
here.
Thank you.
That was South Dakota Secretary of State Monet Johnson joining us live. And that is our show for the 9 o'clock hour, 8 Central. We'll be back at noon Central and 11 Mountain with another live update as SDPB continues our special election coverage today. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.